she couldn't help being fascinated by downworlders still, warlocks in particular. Why were they marked, and she wasn't?
"What's on the carpet then, Charlotte?" Ragnar was saying. "Did you really call me out here to discuss dark doings on the Yorkshire moors? I was under the impression that nothing of great interest ever happened in Yorkshire. In fact, I was under the impression that there was nothing in Yorkshire except sheep and mining."
"So you never knew the Shades?" Charlotte inquired.
"The warlock population of Britain is not so large."
"I knew them."
As Fel sawed into the ham on his plate, Tessa saw that he had an extra joint to each finger. She thought of Mrs. Black, with her elongated, taloned hands, and repressed a shudder.
"Shade was a little mad, with his obsession with clockwork and mechanisms. Their death was a shock to Downworld. The ripples of it went through the community, and there was even some discussion of vengeance, though none, I believe, was ever taken."
Charlotte leaned forward.
"Do you remember their son? Their adopted child?" "I knew of him. A married warlock couple is rare. One who adopts a human child from an orphanage is rarer still. But I never saw the boy. Warlocks, we live forever. A gap of 30, even 50 years between meetings is not unusual. Of course, now that I know what the boy grew up to be, I wish I had met him. Do you think there is value in attempting to discover who his true parents were?"
"Certainly, if it can be discovered.
Whatever information we can glean about Mortmain could be useful."
"I can tell you he gave himself that name," said Fel. "It sounds like a shadow hunter name. It is the sort of name someone with a grudge against Nephilim and a dark sense of humor would take. Mortmain."
"Hand of Death,"
supplied Jessamine, who was proud of her French.
"It does make one wonder," said Tessa. "If the Clave had simply given Mortmain what he wanted, reparations, would he still have become what he did? Would there ever have been a pandemonium club at all?"
"Tessa!"
Charlotte began, but Ragnar fell, waved her silent. He gazed amusedly down the table at Tessa.
"You're the shape-changer, aren't you?" he said. "Magnus Bane told me about you. No mark on you at all, they say."
Tessa swallowed and looked him straight in the eye. They were discordantly human eyes, ordinary in his extraordinary face.
"No, no mark."
He grinned around his fork.
"I do suppose they've looked everywhere."
"I'm sure Will's tried,"
said Jessamine in a bored tone. Tessa's silverware clattered to her plate. Jessamine, who had been mashing her peas flat with the side of her knife, looked up when Charlotte let out in a gasp,
"Jessamine!"
Jessamine shrugged.
"Well, he's like that."
Fel turned back to his plate with a faint smile on his face.
"I remember Will's father. Quite the ladies' man he was. They couldn't resist him. Until he met Will's mother, of course. Then he threw it all in and went to live in Wales, just to be with her. What a case he was."
"He fell in love," said Jem. "It isn't that peculiar."
"Fell into it," said the warlock, still with the same faint smile. "Hurtled into it is more like. Headlong crashed into it. Still, there are always some men like that. Just one woman for them, and only she will do, or nothing."
Charlotte looked over at Henry, but he appeared completely lost in thought, counting something, though who knew what, off on his fingers. He was wearing a pink and violet waistcoat today, and had gravy on his sleeve. Charlotte's shoulders slumped visibly, and she sighed.
"Well," she said, "by all accounts they were very happy together.
Until they lost two of their three children,
and Edmund Herondale gambled away everything they had, said Fel. But I imagine you never told young Will about that.
Tessa exchanged a glance with Jem. My sister is dead, Will had said.
They had three children then, she said. Will had two sisters?
Tessa, please!
Charlotte looked uneasy.
Ragnar, I never hired you to invade the privacy of the Herondales or Will. I did it because I had promised Will I would tell him if harm came to his family.
Tessa thought of Will, a 12-year-old Will clinging to Charlotte's hand, begging to be told if his family died. Why run? She thought for the 100th time. Why put them behind you? She had thought perhaps he did not care, but clearly he had cared, cared still. She could not stop the tightening at her heart as she thought of him calling out for his sister. If he loved Cecily as she had once loved Nate. Mortmain had done something to his family, she thought, as he had to hers. That bound them to each other in a peculiar way, she and Will, whether he knew it or not. Whatever it is that Mortmain has been planning, she heard herself say, he has been planning it a long time since before I was born, when he tricked or coerced my parents into making me. And now we know that years ago he involved himself with Will's family and moved them to Ravenscar Manor. I fear we are like chess pieces he slides about a board, and the outcome of the game is already known to him.
That is what he desires us to think, Tessa, said Jem. But he is only a man, and each discovery we make about him makes him more vulnerable. If we were no threat, he would not have sent that automaton to warn us off. He knew exactly where we would be.
There is nothing more dangerous than a man bent on revenge, said Ragnar. A man who has been bent on it for nearly 70 years, who has nurtured it from a tiny, poisonous seed to a living, choking flower. He will see it through, unless you end him first.
Then we will end him, said Jem shortly.
It was as close to a threat as Tessa had ever heard him make. Tessa looked down at her hands. They were a paler white than they had been when she lived in New York, but they were her hands, familiar, the index finger slightly longer than the middle one, the half-moons of her nails pronounced. I could change them, she thought. I could become anything, anyone. She had never felt more mutable, more fluid, or more lost.
Indeed, Charlotte's tone was firm. Ragnar, I want to know why the Herondale family is in that house that belonged to Mortmain, and I want to see to it that they are safe. And I want to do it without Benedict Lightwood or the rest of the Clave hearing about it.
I understand. You want me to look out for them as quietly as possible, while also making inquiries regarding Mortmain in the area. If he moved them there, it must have been for a purpose.
Charlotte exhaled.
Yes.
Ragnar twirled his fork.
That will be expensive.
Yes, Charlotte said. I am prepared to pay.
Fel grinned.
Then I am prepared to endure the sheep.
The rest of the lunch passed in awkward conversation, with Jessamine moodily destroying her food without eating it, Jem unusually quiet, Henry muttering equations to himself, and Charlotte and Fel finalizing their plans for the protection of Will's family. As much as Tessa approved of the idea, and she did, there was something about the warlock that made her uncomfortable in a way Magnus never had. And she was glad when lunch was over and she could escape to her room with a copy of The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. It was not her favorite of the Bronte sisters' books. That honor went to Jane Eyre, and then Wuthering Heights, with Tennant a distant third. But she had read the other two so many times that no surprises lay between the pages, Only phrases so familiar to her they had become like old friends. What she really wanted to read was A Tale of Two Cities, but Will had quoted Sidney Carton to her enough times that she was afraid that picking it up would make her think of him, and make the weight of her nervousness greater. After all, it was never Darnay he quoted, only Sidney, drunk and wrecked and dissipated. Sidney, who died for love. It was dark out, and the wind was blowing gusts of light rain against the window panes, when the knock came at her door. It was Sophie, carrying a letter on a silver tray.
"A letter for you, miss."
Tessa put the book down in astonishment.
"Mail for me?"
Sophie nodded and came closer, holding out the tray.
"Yes, but it doesn't say who it's from. Miss Lovelace almost snatched it, but I managed to keep it from her, nosy thing."
Tessa took the envelope. It was addressed to her, indeed, in a slanting, unfamiliar hand, printed on heavy, cream-colored paper. She turned it over once, began to open it, and caught sight of Sophie's wide-eyed, curious gaze reflected in the window. She turned and smiled at her. "That will be all, Sophie," she said. It was the way she had read heroines dismissing servants in novels, and it seemed to be correct. With a disappointed look, Sophie took her salver and retired from the room. Tessa unfolded the letter and spread it out on her lap. "Dear sensible Miss Gray, I write to you on behalf of a mutual friend, one William Herondale. I know that it is his habit to come and go, most often go, from the Institute as he pleases, and that therefore it may be some time before any alarm is raised at his absence. But I ask you, as one who holds your good sense in esteem, not to assume this absence to be of the ordinary sort. I saw him myself last night, and he was, to say the least, distraught when he left my residence. I have reason for concern that he might do himself an injury, and therefore I suggest that his whereabouts be sought, and his safety ascertained. He is a difficult young man to like, but I believe you see the good in him, as I do, Miss Gray, and that is why I humbly address my letter to you. Your servant, Magnus Bane. Postscript. If I were you, I would not share the contents of this letter with Mrs. Bramwell. Just a suggestion. M.B. Though reading Magnus's letter made her feel as if her veins were full of fire, somehow Tessa survived the rest of the afternoon and dinner as well without, she thought, betraying any outward sign of her distress. It seemed to take Sophie an agonizingly long time to help her out of her dress, brush her hair, stoke the fire, and tell her the day's gossip. Cyril's cousin worked in Lightwood's house and had reported that Tatiana, Gabriel and Gideon's sister, was due to return from her honeymoon on the continent with her new husband any day now. The household was in an uproar, as she was rumored to have a most unpleasant disposition. Tessa muttered something about how she must take after her father that way. Impatience made her voice a croak, and Sophie was only just prevented from rushing out to get her a tisane of mint by Tessa's insistence that she was exhausted and needed sleep more than she needed tea. The moment the door shut behind Sophie, Tessa was on her feet, shimmying out of her night clothes and into a dress, lacing herself up as best she could, and throwing a short jacket on over the top. After a cautious glance out into the corridor, she slipped out of her room and across the hall to Jem's door, where she knocked as quietly as she could. For a moment, nothing happened, and she had the fleeting worry that he had already gone to sleep. But then the door flew open, and Jem stood on the threshold. She had clearly caught him in the middle of readying himself for bed. His shoes and jacket were off, his shirt open at the collar, his hair an adorable, rumpled mess of silver. She wanted to reach out and smooth it down. He blinked at her.
"Tessa?"
Without a word, she handed him the note. He glanced up and down the corridor, then gestured her inside the room. She shut the door behind him as he read Magnus's scrawl once, and then again, before balling it up in his hand, the crackling paper loud in the room.
"I knew it," he said.
It was Tessa's turn to blink.
"Knew what?"
"That this wasn't an ordinary sort of absence." He sat down on the trunk at the foot of his bed and shoved his feet into his shoes.
"I felt it. Here."
He put his hand over his chest.
"I knew there was something strange. I felt it like a shadow on my soul."
"You don't think he'd really hurt himself, do you?"
"Hurt himself? I don't know. Put himself in a situation where he might be hurt."
Jem stood up.
"I should go."
"Don't you mean we? You weren't thinking of going looking for Will without me, were you?" she asked archly. And when he said nothing, she said, "That letter was addressed to me, James. I didn't have to show it to you." He half closed his eyes for a moment, and when he opened them, he was smiling crookedly.
"James," he said. "Ordinarily, only Will calls me that."
"I'm sorry."
"No, don't be.
I like the sound of it on your lips." Lips. There was something strangely, delicately indelicate about the word, like a kiss itself. It seemed to hover in the air between them while they both hesitated.
"But it's Jem," Tessa thought in bewilderment. "Jem, not Will, who could make her feel as if he were running his fingers along her bare skin just by looking at her."
"You're right," Jem said, clearing his throat. "Magnus would not have sent the letter to you, had he not intended you to be part of searching for Will. Perhaps he thinks your power will be useful. In either case..."
He turned from her, going to his wardrobe and flinging it open.
"Wait for me in your room. I will be there momentarily."
Tessa wasn't sure if she nodded. She thought she had. And moments later she found herself back in her bedroom, leaning against the door. Her face felt hot, as if she had stood too close to a fire. She looked around. When had she started to think of this room as her bedroom? The big, grand space, with its mullioned windows and softly glowing witch-light tapers, was so unlike the tiny box room she had slept in the flat in New York, with its puddles of wax on the bedside table, caused by her staying up all night reading by candlelight, and the cheap wooden-framed bed with its thin blankets. In the winter, the windows, ill-seated, would rattle in their frames when the wind blew. A soft knock on the door drew her out of her reverie, and she turned, flinging it open to find Jem on the threshold. He was fully dressed in Shadowhunter gear, the tough, leather-looking black coat and trousers, the heavy boots. He put a finger to his lips and gestured for her to follow him. It was probably 10 o'clock at night, Tessa guessed, and the witch light was burning low. They took a curious winding path through the corridors, not the one she was used to taking to get to the front doors. Her confusion was answered when they reached a door set at the end of a long corridor. There was a rounded look to the space they stood in, and Tessa guessed they were probably inside one of the Gothic towers that stood at each corner of the Institute. Jem pushed the door open and ushered her in after him. He closed the door firmly behind them, slipping the key he had used back into his pocket.
"This," he said, "is Will's room."
"Gracious," Tessa said. "I've never been in here. I was starting to imagine he slept upside down, like a bat." Jem laughed and went past her, over to a wooden bureau and began to rummage through the contents on top of it, as Tessa glanced around. Her heart was beating fast, as if she were seeing something she wasn't meant to see, some secret, hidden part of Will. She told herself not to be silly. It was just a room, with the same heavy, dark furniture as all the other Institute rooms. It was a mess, too. Covers kicked down to the foot of the bed, clothes draped over the backs of chairs, teacups half full or liquid not yet cleared away, balanced precariously on the nightstand. And everywhere, books. Books on the side tables, books on the bed, books in stacks on the floor, books double-lined in shelves along the walls. As Jem rummaged, Tessa wandered to the shelves and looked curiously at the titles. She was not surprised to find that they were almost all fiction and poetry. Some were titles in languages she couldn't read. She recognized Latin and the Greek alphabet. There were also books of fairy tales, The Arabian Nights, James Payne's work, Anthony Trollope's Vicar of Bullhampton, Thomas Hardy's Desperate Remedies, a pile of Wilkie Collins, The New Magdalen, The Law and the Lady, The Two Destinies, and a new Jules Verne novel titled Child of the Cavern that she itched to get her hands on. And then, there it was, A Tale of Two Cities. With a rueful smile, she reached to take it from the shelf. As she lifted it, several scrawled-on papers that had been pressed between the covers fluttered to the floor. She knelt to pick them up, and froze. She recognized the handwriting instantly. It was her own. Her throat tightened as she thumbed through the pages. "Dear Nate," she read, "I tried to change today and failed. It was a coin they gave me, and I could get nothing from it. Either it was never owned by a person, or my power is weakening. I would not care, but that they whipped me. Have you ever been whipped before? No, a silly question. Of course you haven't. It feels like fire being laid in lines across your skin. I am ashamed to say I cried, and you know how I hate to cry. And, dear Nate, I missed you so much today, I thought I would die. If you are gone, there is no one in the world who cares if I am dead or alive. I feel myself dissolving, vanishing into nothingness. For if there is no one in the world who cares for you, do you really exist at all?" Those were the letters she had written her brother from the dark house, not expecting Nate to read them, not expecting anyone to read them. They were more of a diary than letters, the only place where she could pour forth her horror, her sadness, and her fear. She knew that they had been found, that Charlotte had read them. But what were they doing here in Will's room, of all places, hidden between the pages of a book?
"Tessa!"
It was Jem. She turned quickly, slipping the letters into the pocket of her coat as she did so. Jem stood by the bureau, holding a silver knife in his hand.
"By the angel, this place is such a tip. I wasn't sure I'd be able to find it."
He turned it over in his hands.
"Will didn't bring much from home when he came here, but he did bring this. It's a dagger his father gave him. It has the Herondale bird markings on the blade. It should have a strong enough imprint of him for us to track him with it."
Despite the encouraging words, he was frowning.
"What's wrong?"
Tessa asked, crossing the room to him.
"I found something else," he said. "Will has always been the one to buy my medicine for me. He knew I despised the whole transaction, finding downworlders willing to sell it, paying for the stuff."
His chest rose and fell quickly, as if merely talking about it sickened him.
"I would give him money, and off he would go. I found a bill, though, for the last transaction. It appears the drugs, the medicine, does not cost what I thought it did."
"You mean Will's been cheating you out of money?" Tessa was surprised. Will could be awful and cruel, she thought, but somehow she had thought his cruelty of a more refined order than that, less petty, and to do that to Jem, of all people.
"Quite the opposite. The drugs cost much more than he said they did. He must have been making up the difference somehow."
Still frowning, he slid the dagger into his belt.
"I know him better than anyone else in the world," he said matter-of-factly. "And yet, still I find that Will has secrets that surprise me."
Tessa thought of the letters stuffed into the Dickens book, and what she intended to say to Will about it when she saw him again. Indeed, she said. Though it is not so much a mystery, is it? Will would do anything for you.
I'm not sure I would take it quite that far.
Jem's tone was wry. Of course he would, said Tessa. Anyone would. You're so kind and so good. She broke off, but Jem's eyes had already widened. He looked surprised, as if he were not used to such praise, but surely he must be, Tessa thought in confusion. Surely everyone who knew him knew how lucky they were. She felt her cheeks begin to warm again and cursed herself. What was going on? A faint rattle came from the window. Jem turned after a moment's pause.
That will be Cyril,
he said, and there was a slight rough undercurrent to his voice.
I asked him to bring the carriage around. We had better go.
Tess nodded, wordless, and followed him from the room. When Jem and Tessa emerged from the Institute, the wind was still gusting into the courtyard, sending dried leaves skittering in circles like fairy dancers. The sky was heavy with a yellow fog, the moon a gold disk behind it. The Latin words over the Institute's gate seemed to glow, picked out by the moonlight. We are dust and shadows. Cyril, waiting with the carriage and the two horses, Belios and Xanthos, looked relieved to see them. He helped Tessa up into the carriage, Jem following her, and then swung himself up into the driver's seat. Tessa, sitting opposite Jem, watched with fascination as he drew both the dagger and the steely from his belt. Holding the dagger in his right hand, he drew a rune on the back of that hand with the tip of his steely. It looked to Tessa like all marks looked, a ripple of unreadable, waving lines, circling around to connect with one another in bold black patterns. He gazed down at his hand for a long moment, then shut his eyes, his face still with intense concentration. Just as Tessa's nerves began to sing with impatience, his eyes flew open.
Brick Lane, near Whitechapel High Street, he said, half to himself, returning the dagger and steely to his belt.
He leaned out the window, and she heard him repeat the words to Cyril. A moment later, Jem was back in the carriage, shutting the window against the cold air, and they were sliding and bumping forward over the cobblestones. Tessa took a deep breath. She had been eager to look for Will all day, worried about him, wondering where he was. But now that they were rolling into the dark heart of London, all she could feel was dread.
Chapter 9. A Fierce Midnight. Fierce midnights and famishing morrows, and the loves that complete and control. All the joys of the flesh, all the sorrows that wear out the soul. Algernon Charles Swinburne. Dolores.
Tessa kept the curtain on her side of the carriage pulled back, her eyes on the glass of the window as they rolled along Fleet Street toward Ludgate Hill. The yellow fog had thickened, and she could make out little through it. The dark shapes of people hurrying to and fro, the hazy words of advertising signs painted on the sides of buildings. Every once in a while the fog would part and she would get a clear glimpse of something, a little girl carrying bunches of wilting lavender, leaning against a wall, exhausted. A knife grinder rolling his cart wearily homeward. A sign for Bryant and Mays, Lucifer Matches, looming suddenly out of the gloom.
Chuckaways, said Jem.
He was leaning back against the seat across from her, his eyes bright in the dimness. She wondered if he had taken some of the drug before they left, and if so, how much.
Pardon?
He mimed the act of striking a match, blowing it out, and tossing the remainder over his shoulder.
That's what they call matches here, chuckaways, because you toss them aside after one use. It's also what they call the girls who work at the match factories.
Tessa thought of Sophie, who could easily have become one of those chuckaways, if Charlotte hadn't found her. That's cruel.
It's a cruel part of the city we're going into. The East End. The slums. He sat forward. I want you to be careful and to stay close by me. Do you know what Will's doing there? Tessa asked, half afraid of the answer. They were passing by the great bulk of St. Paul's now, looming up above them, like a giant's glimmering marble tombstone. Jem shook his head.
I don't. I only got a sense, a fleeting image of the street from the tracking spell. I will say, though, that there are few harmless reasons for a gentleman to go down to chapel after dark.
He could be gambling.
He could be, Jem agreed,
sounding as if he doubted it. You said he would sense it. Here. Tessa touched herself over the heart. If something had happened to him, is that because you're Parabatai?
Yes.
So there's more to being Parabatai than just swearing to look out for each other. There's something mystical about it. Jem smiled at her. That smile that was like a light suddenly being turned on in every room of a house.
We're Nephilim. Every one of our life's passages has some mystical component. Our births, our deaths, our marriages, everything has a ceremony. There is one as well if you wish to become someone's Parabatai. First, you must ask them, of course. It's no small commitment. You asked Will, Tessa guessed.
Jem shook his head, still smiling.
He asked me, he said.
Or rather, he told me.
We were training, up in the training room, with long swords. He asked me, and I said no. He deserved someone who was going to live, who could look out for him all his life. He bet me he could get the sword away from me, and if he succeeded, I'd have to agree to be his blood brother.
And he got it away from you?
In 9 seconds flat, Jem laughed.
Pinned me to the wall. He must have been training without my knowing about it, because I'd never have agreed if I'd thought he was that good with a long sword. Throwing daggers have always been his weapons.
He shrugged.
We were 13. They did the ceremony when we were 14. Now it's been 3 years, and I can't imagine not having a Parabatai.
Why didn't you want to do it? Tessa asked a little hesitantly, when he first asked you.
Jem ran a hand through his silvery hair. The ceremony binds you, he said. It makes you stronger. You have each other's strength to draw on. It makes you more aware of where the other one is, so you can work seamlessly together in a fight. There are runes you can use if you are part of a pair of Parabatai that you can't use otherwise, but you can choose only one Parabatai in your life. You can't have a second, even if the first one dies. I didn't think I was a very good bet, considering.
That seems a harsh rule. Jem said something then, in a language she didn't understand. It sounded like Kalepa Takala. She frowned at him.
That isn't Latin.
Greek, he said. It has two meanings. It means that which is worth having, the good, fine, honorable, and noble things, are difficult to attain.
He leaned forward closer to her. She could smell the sweet scent of the drug on him and the tang of his skin underneath.
It means something else as well.
Tessa swallowed.
What's that?
It means beauty is harsh.
She glanced down at his hands. Slim, fine, capable hands with blunt-cut nails and scars across the knuckles. Were any of the Nephilim unscarred?
These words, they have a special appeal to you, don't they?
She asked softly.
These dead languages. Why is that?
He was leaning close enough to her that she felt his warm breath on her cheek when he exhaled.
I cannot be sure, he said, though I think it has something to do with the clarity of them. Greek, Latin, Sanskrit, they contain pure truths. Before we cluttered our languages with so many useless words.
But what of your language? She said softly.
The one you grew up speaking. His lips twitched.
I grew up speaking English.
And Mandarin Chinese, he said.
My father spoke English and Chinese badly. After we moved to Shanghai, it was even worse. The dialect there is barely intelligible by someone who speaks Mandarin.
Say something in Mandarin, said Tessa with a smile. Jem said something rapidly that sounded like a lot of breathy vowels and consonants run together, his voice rising and falling melodically.
Ni hen pian lang?
What did you say?
I said your hair is coming undone. Here, he said, and reached out and tucked an escaping curl back behind her ear. Tessa felt the blood spill hot up into her cheeks, and was glad for the dimness of the carriage.
You have to be careful with it, he said, taking his hand back slowly, his fingers lingering against her cheek.
You don't want to give the enemy anything to grab hold of.
Oh, yes, of course. Tessa looked quickly toward the window and stared. The yellow fog hung heavy over the streets, but she could see well enough. They were in a narrow thoroughfare, though broad, perhaps, by London standards. The air seemed thick and greasy with coal dust and fog, and the streets were lined with people. Filthy, dressed in rags, they slumped against the walls of tipsy-looking buildings, their eyes watching the carriage go by like hungry dogs following the progress of a bone. Tessa saw a woman wrapped in a shawl, a basket of flowers drooping from one hand, a baby folded into a corner of the shawl propped against her shoulder. Its eyes were closed, its skin as pale as curd. It looked sick or dead. Barefoot children, as dirty as homeless cats, played together in the streets. Women sat leaning against one another on the stoops of buildings, obviously drunk. The men were worst of all, slumped against the sides of houses, dressed in dirty, patched topcoats and hats, the looks of hopelessness on their faces, like etchings on gravestones. Rich Londoners from Mayfair and Chelsea like to take midnight tours of districts like these, said Jem, his voice uncharacteristically bitter.
They call it slumming.
Do they stop and help in some way?
Most of them know. They just want to stare so they can go home and talk at their next tea party about how they saw real mug hunters or dolly mops or shivering jemmies. Most of them never get out of the carriages or omnibuses.
What's a shivering jemmy? Jem looked at her with flat silver eyes.
A freezing, ragged beggar, he said. Someone likely to die of the cold.
Tessa thought of the thick paper pasted over the cracks in the window panes in her New York apartment. But at least she had had a bedroom, a place to lie down, and Aunt Harriet to make her hot soup or tea over the small range. She had been lucky. The carriage came to a stop at an unprepossessing corner. Across the street, the lights of an open public house spilled out onto the street, along with a steady stream of drunkards, some with women leaning on their arms, the women's brightly colored dresses stained and dirty and their cheeks highly rouged. Somewhere, someone was singing Cruel Lizzie Vickers. Jem took her hand.
I can't glamour you against the glances of mundanes, he said. So keep your head down and keep close to me.
Tessa smiled crookedly, but didn't take her hand out of his.
You said that already.
He leaned close and whispered into her ear. His breath sent a shiver racing through her whole body.
It's very important.
He reached past her for the door and swung it open. He leaped down onto the pavement and helped her down after him, pulling her close against his side. Tessa looked up and down the street. There were some incurious stares from the crowds, but the two of them were largely ignored. They headed toward a narrow door painted red. There were steps around it, but unlike all the other steps in the area, they were bare. No one was sitting on them. Jem took them quickly, pulling her up after him, and rapped sharply on the door. It was opened after a moment by a woman in a long red dress, fitted so tightly to her body that Tessa's eyes widened. She had black hair piled on her head, kept in place by a pair of gold chopsticks. Her skin was very pale. Her eyes rimmed with coal. But on closer examination, Tessa realized she was white, not foreign. Her mouth was a sulky red bow. It turned down at the corners as her gaze came to rest on Jem.
No, she said. No, Nephilim.
She moved to shut the door, but Jem had raised his cane. The blade shot out from the base of it, holding the door open wide.
No trouble, he said. We're not here for the clave. It's personal.
She narrowed her eyes.
We're looking for someone, he said. A friend. Take us to him and we won't bother you further.
At that, she threw her head back and laughed.
I know who you're looking for, she said. There's only one of your kind here.
She turned away from the door with a shrug of contempt. Jem's blade slid back into its casing with a hiss, and he ducked under the low lintel, drawing Tessa after him. Beyond the door was a narrow corridor. A heavy, sweet smell hung on the air, like the smell that hung about Jem's clothing after he had taken his drug. Her hand tightened involuntarily on his.
This is where Will comes to buy the... to buy what I need, he whispered, inclining his head so that his lips nearly touched her ear. Although why he would be here now.
The woman who had opened the door for them glanced back over her shoulder as she set off down the hall. There was a slit up the back of her dress, showing much of her legs, and the end of a long, slender, forked tail, marked with black and white markings like the scales of a snake.
She's a warlock, Tessa thought, with a dull thud at her heart. Ragnar, the Dark Sisters, this woman? Why was it that warlocks always seemed so sinister? With the exception of Magnus, perhaps, but she had the feeling Magnus was an exception to many rules.
The corridor widened out into a large room, its walls painted dark red. Great lamps, their sides carved and painted with delicate traceries that threw patterned light against the walls, hung down from the ceiling. Along the walls were ranged beds, in bunks, like the inside of a ship. A large round table dominated the center of the room. At it sat a number of men, their skin the same blood-red as the walls, their black hair clipped close to their heads. Their hands ended in blue-black talons that had also been clipped, probably to allow them to more easily count and sift and mix the various powders and concoctions they had spread out before them. The powders seemed to glimmer and shine under the lamplight like pulverized jewels.
"Is this an opium den?"
Tessa whispered into Jem's ear. His eyes were raking the room anxiously. She could sense the tension in him, a thrum just under the skin, like the fast-beating heart of a hummingbird.
No, he sounded distracted. Not really. Mostly demon drugs and fairy powders. Those men at the table, they're ifrits. Warlocks without powers.
The woman in the red dress was leaning over the shoulder of one of the ifrits. Together they looked up and over at Tessa and Jem, their eyes lingering on Jem. Tessa didn't like the way they were looking at him. The warlock woman was smiling. The ifrit's look was calculating. The woman straightened up and swayed over to them, her hips moving like a metronome under the tight satin of her dress.
Madran says we have what you want, silver boy, said the warlock woman, raking a blood-red nail across Jem's cheek. No need for pretense.
Jem flinched back from her touch. Tessa had never seen him look so unnerved.
I told you, we're here for a friend, he snapped. A Nephilim. Blue eyes, black hair.
His voice rose.
Tajan, Zai Zai Nali?
She looked at him for a moment, then shook her head.
You are foolish, she said. There is little of the Yin Fen left, and when it is gone, you will die. We struggle to obtain more, but lately the demand...
Spare us your attempts to sell your merchandise, said Tessa, suddenly angry. She couldn't bear the look on Jem's face, as if each word were the cut of a knife. No wonder Will bought his poisons for him. Where is our friend? The warlock woman hissed, shrugged, and pointed toward one of the bunk beds bolted to the wall.
There.
Jem whitened as Tessa stared. Their occupants were so still that at first she had thought the beds were empty, but she realized now, looking more closely, that each was taken up by a sprawled figure. Some lay on their sides, arms trailing over the edges of the bed, hands splayed. Most were on their backs, eyes open, staring at the ceiling of the bunk above them. Without another word, Jem began to stalk across the room, Tessa on his heels. As they drew closer to the beds, she realized that not all the occupants were human. Blue, violet, red, and green skin flashed past. Green hair as long and netted as a web of seaweed brushed restlessly against a dirty pillow. Taloned fingers gripped the wooden sides of a bunk as someone moaned. Someone else was giggling softly, hopelessly, a sound sadder than weeping. Another voice repeated a children's rhyme over and over and over again.
"Oranges and lemons, say the bells of St. Clemens, when will you pay me? Ring the bells at Old Bailey. When I grow rich, say the bells of Shoreditch."
"Will,"
whispered Jem. He had stopped at a bunk halfway down the wall and leaned against it as if his legs threatened to give way. Lying in the bunk was Will, half tangled in a dark, ragged blanket. He wore nothing but trousers and a shirt. His weapons belt hung on a nail peg inside the bunk. His feet were bare, his eyes half-lidded, their blue only slightly visible beneath the fringe of his dark lashes. His hair was wet with sweat, pasted to his forehead, his cheeks bright red and feverish. His chest rose and fell raggedly, as if he were having trouble drawing breath. Tessa reached out and put the back of her hand to his forehead. It was burning.
"Jem," she said softly. "Jem, we must get him out of here."
The man in the bunk beside them was still singing. Not that he was quite a man, exactly. His body was short and twisted, his shoeless feet ending in cloven hooves.
"When will that be? Say the bells of Stepney. I do not know, says the great bell of Bow."
Jem was still staring down at Will, motionless. He seemed frozen. His face had gone a patchy white and red color.
"Jem," Tessa whispered, "please, help me get him on his feet."
When Jem did not move, she reached out, took Will by the shoulder, and shook him.
"Will! Will! Wake up, please!"
Will only groaned and turned away from her, burying his head against his arm. He was a shadow hunter, she thought, 6 feet of bone and muscle, far too heavy for her to lift. Unless...
"If you do not help me," Tessa said to Jem, "I swear I will change into you and I will lift him myself. And then everyone here will see what you look like in a dress."
She fixed him with a look.
"Do you understand?"
Very slowly he raised his eyes to her. He did not look fazed by the idea of being seen by Ifrits in a dress. He did not look as if he saw her at all. It was the first time she could remember seeing those silver eyes without any light behind them.
"Do you?"
he said, and reached into the bunk, catching Will by the arm and hauling him sideways, taking little care and bumping Will's head hard against the side rail of the bed. Will groaned and opened his eyes.
"Let me go.
Help me with him,"
Jem said without looking at Tessa, and together they wrestled Will out of the bunk. He nearly fell, sliding his arm around Tessa to balance himself as Jem retrieved his weapons belt from the nail it was hanging from.
"Tell me this is not a dream," Will whispered, nuzzling his face into the side of her neck.
Tessa jumped. He felt feverishly hot against her skin. His lips grazed her cheekbone. They were as soft as she remembered.
Jem, Tessa said desperately, and Jem looked over at them. He had been buckling Will's belt over his own, and it seemed clear he hadn't heard a word Will had said.
He knelt down to stuff Will's feet into his boots, then rose to take his Parabatai's arm. Will seemed delighted by this.
"Oh, good," he said. "Now we're all free together."
"Shut up," said Jem.
Will giggled. "Listen, Carstairs, you haven't any of the needful on you, have you? I'd stump up, but I'm flat out."
"What did he say?"
Tessa was baffled.
"He wants me to pay for his drugs."
Jem's voice was stiff.
"Come, we'll get him to the carriage, and I'll come back with the money."
As they struggled toward the door, Tessa heard the voice of the cloven-footed man, following them, thin and as high as music piped through reeds, ending in a high-pitched giggle.
"Here comes a candle to light you to bed, and here comes a chopper to chop off your head."
Even the dirty Whitechapel air seemed clear and fresh after the cloying incense stench of the fairy drug den. Tessa almost stumbled going down the stairs. The carriage was, thankfully, still at the curb, and Cyril was swinging himself down out of the seat, heading over to them, concern on his big, open face.
"Is he all right, then?"
he said, taking the arm that Will had draped over Tessa's shoulders and draping it over his own. Tessa slipped aside gratefully. Her back had begun to ache. Will, predictably, though, did not like this.
"Let me go,"
he said with sudden irritation.
"Let me go. I can stand."
Jem and Cyril exchanged glances, then moved apart. Will staggered, but stayed upright. He raised his head, the cold wind lifting the sweaty hair from his neck and forehead, blowing it across his eyes. Tessa thought of him up on the roof of the Institute.
"And I behold London, a human, awful wonder of God."
He looked at Jem. His eyes were bluer than blue, his cheeks flushed, his features angelic. He said,
"You did not have to come and fetch me like some child. I was having quite a pleasant time."
Jem looked back at him.
"God damn you,"
he said, and hit Will across the face, sending him spinning. Will didn't lose his footing, but fetched up against the side of the carriage, his hand to his cheek. His mouth was bleeding. He looked at Jem with total astonishment.
"Get into the carriage,"
Jem said to Cyril, and turned and went through the red door to pay for whatever Will had taken, Tessa thought. Will was still staring after him, the blood reddening his mouth.
"James?"
he said.
"Come along, then,"
said Cyril, not unkindly.
He really was awfully like Thomas, Tessa thought as he opened the carriage door and helped Will inside,
and then Tessa after him. He gave her a handkerchief from his pocket. It was warm and smelled like cheap eau de cologne. She smiled and thanked him as he shut the door. Will was slumped in the corner of the carriage, his arms around himself, his eyes half open. Blood had trickled down his chin. She leaned over and pressed the handkerchief to his mouth. He reached up and put his hand over hers, holding it there.
"I've made a mess of things," he said.
"Haven't I?"
"Dreadfully, I'm afraid," said Tessa, trying not to notice the warmth of his hand over hers. Even in the darkness of the carriage, his eyes were luminously blue. What was it Jem had said, though, about beauty?
"Beauty is harsh."
Would people forgive Will the things he did if he were ugly? And did it help him in the end to be forgiven? Though she could not help but feel he did the things he did not because he loved himself too much, but because he hated himself, and she did not know why. He closed his eyes.
"Oh, I'm so tired, Tess,"
he said.
I only wanted pleasant dreams for once. That is not the way to get them, Will, she said softly. You cannot buy or drug or dream your way out of pain. His hand tightened over hers. The carriage door opened. Tessa drew back from Will hastily. It was Jem, his face like thunder. He spared a cursory glance at Will, threw himself into a seat, and reached up to rap on the roof.
Cyril, drive home, he called,
and after a moment the carriage lurched forward into the night. Jem reached out and drew the curtains across the windows. In the dimness, Tessa slipped the handkerchief into her sleeve. It was still damp with Will's blood. Jem said nothing all the way back from Whitechapel, merely stared stonily ahead of him with his arms folded, while Will slept, a faint smile on his face in the corner of the carriage. Tessa, across from them both, could think of nothing to say to break Jem's silence. This was so utterly unlike him. Jem, who was always sweet, always kind, always optimistic. His expression now was worse than blank. His nails digging into the fabric of his gear, his shoulders stiff and angular with rage. The moment they drew up in front of the Institute, he threw the door open and leaped out. She heard him shout something to Cyril about helping Will to his room, and then he stalked away up the steps without another word to her. Tessa was so shocked, she could only stare after him for a moment. She moved to the carriage door. Cyril was already there, his hand up to help her down. Barely had Tessa's shoes hit the cobblestones, then she was hurrying after Jem, calling his name, but he was already inside the Institute. He had left the door open for her, and she dashed in after him, after only a brief glance to confirm that Will was being helped by Cyril. She hurried up the stairs, dropping her voice as she realized that, of course, the Institute was asleep. The witchlight torches dimmed to their lowest glow. She went to Jem's room first and knocked. When there was no answer, she sought a few of his most commonly visited haunts, the music room, the library, but finding nothing, she returned, disconsolate, to her own room to ready herself for bed. In her nightgown, her dress brushed and hung up, she crawled between the sheets of her bed and stared at the ceiling. She even picked up Will's copy of Vatek from her floor, but for the first time the poem in the front failed to make her smile, and she could not concentrate on the story. She was startled at her own distress. Jem was angry at Will, not at her. Still, she thought, it was perhaps the first time he had lost his temper in front of her. The first time he had been curt with her, or not attended with kindness to her words, had not seemed to think of her first before himself. She had taken him for granted, she thought with surprise and shame, watching the flickering candlelight. She had assumed his kindness was so natural and so innate. She had never asked herself whether it cost him any effort. Any effort to stand between Will and the world, protecting each of them from the other. Any effort to accept the loss of his family with equanimity. Any effort to remain cheerful and calm in the face of his own dying. A rending noise, the sound of something being wrenched apart, tore through the room. Tessa sat bolt upright. What was that? It seemed to be coming from outside her door, across the hall. Jem? She leaped to her feet and caught her dressing gown down from its peg. Hurriedly slipping into it, she darted out the door and into the corridor. She had been correct. The noise was coming from Jem's room. She remembered the first night she had met him, the lovely violin music that had poured like water through the doorway. This noise sounded nothing like Jem's music. She could hear the saw of bow against string. It had sounded like screaming, like a person screaming in awful pain. She both longed to go in and felt terrified to do so. Finally, she took hold of the knob of the door and swung it open, and then ducked inside and pulled the door closed fast after her. "Jem," she whispered.
The witchlight torches were burning low on the walls. Jem sat on the trunk at the foot of his bed, in just his shirt sleeves and trousers, his silver hair tousled, the violin propped against his shoulder. He was sawing at it viciously with the bow, wringing awful sounds out of it, making it scream. As Tessa watched, one of the violin strings snapped with a shriek.
"Jem!"
she cried again, and when he did not look up, she strode across the room and wrenched the bow out of his hand.
"Jem, stop! Your violin! Your lovely violin! You'll ruin it!"
He looked up at her. His pupils were enormous, the silver of his eyes only a thin ring around the black. He was breathing hard, his shirt open at the neck, sweat standing out on his collarbones. His cheeks were flushed.
"What does it matter?"
he said, in a voice so low it was almost a hiss.
"What does any of it matter? I'm dying. I won't outlast the decade. What does it matter if the violin goes before I do?"
Tessa was appalled. He never spoke like this about his illness. Never. He stood up and turned away from her, toward the window. Only a little moonlight found its way into the room through the fog. There seemed to be shapes, visible in the white mist pressed against the window. Ghosts, shades, mocking faces.
"You know, it is true."
"Nothing is decided," her voice shook.
"Nothing is inevitable. A cure? There's no cure."
He no longer sounded angry, just detached, which was almost worse.
"I will die, and you know it, Tess. Probably within the next year. I am dying, and I have no family in the world. And the one person I trusted more than any other made sport of what is killing me."
"But, Jem, I don't think that's what Will meant to do at all." Tessa leaned the bow against